LLI@UIUC.edu. Programming on AM 580 is made possible in part by a grant from the Thrifty Nichols American Classifieds, distributed each Thursday in over 100 towns in East Central Illinois, on the web at AmericanClassifieds.com.
And good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. My name is Les Schulte. I'm filling in for David Inge again this morning. And David will be here via recording during the second hour. We're going back to the archives for an interview David did called Our Inner Ape. A leading primatologist explains why we are who we are. And that's coming up during the 11 o'clock hour from the archives. But right now, we have a frequent guest with us during this first hour of Focus, and it's Sandy Mason. Sandy is a unit educator in horticulture and environment at the University of Illinois Extension. And Sandy, good morning.
Good morning.
And I understand you're just back from vacation, huh?
Yes, and of all places, I actually went to Florida, which people always wonder, why do you go to Florida in the summertime?
Sure, in the summertime.
But, my father lives down there, and it actually is, it's nice. It's interesting to go to different places like that and mm-hmm. see what kind of plants they have and what survives in heat and drought.
Well, speaking of that, going to places you probably wouldn't want to go in the summer, next week, my wife and I are going to Phoenix because her mom and dad live there. And Phoenix in July, I can tell you, is very, very hot.
Yes. Probably record temperatures.
I think so. So if you have a question for Sandy Mason, give us a call at 333-9455, or if you're outside the 217 area code, 800-222-9455. I have a couple of things I'd like to talk about, but first, why don't we just go to the phone lines right away? We have a call on line one and a caller from Champaign. Good morning. You're on the air with Sandy Mason.
Good morning. This year, I'm having problems with my tomatoes. They're coming in as they mature and get ripe. They are rotting on the bottom. Mm-hmm. What do you call that, and what do I need to do?
Yeah, it's probably blossom end rot, and they're still edible. You can still eat them. I wouldn't can them or do any kind of processing with them, but they are still edible. And it really, unfortunately, so much of it has to do with our weather, which we can't do a whole heck of a lot about. But I can tell you a few things that may help it. It always tends to be worse when we have really hot, humid temperatures. Well, yeah, there you go. How many times do we have hot, humid temperatures? So, you know, part of it is that. But what you can do to help is, do you have a mulched at all? Do you have anything like...
Do I have any or have
any like mulch or like, you know, like grass clippings or something like that? Because one of the things they have found that makes it worse is if they go wet, dry, wet, dry, wet, dry. So if you can keep an even moisture, that helps a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be number one, just trying to keep them moist. Obviously, sometimes that's a little bit difficult, but that's why mulching sometimes helps.
Okay.
Helps to even out the soil temperatures, also helps to even out that moisture. So if you have just a thin layer of grass clippings, that's fine. Kind of whatever you have, if you have compost, that's fine. You know, anything along those lines, even shredded leaves, that would be good. Just anything along those lines, they have a nice mulch, that will help. And then it does subside as we get into, it looks like this next week or so, actually the rest of this week, looks like the temperatures are going to get a little bit more moderate, and then you'll notice that those new ones then look much better.
So I shouldn't assume that all the ones on a particular plant are going to be that way just because a few are
right,
that way.
Right, absolutely. So much of it has to do is when they're developing, what the temperature and what the humidity, all that kind of stuff is when they're developing. Then the temperature changes, and then that same plant will produce decent ones after that.
Okay, thank mm-hmm. you.
Right, yeah. Thanks for your call.
And you can always pick them green, which is sometimes if you seem like you have lots of problems with that, you can pick them. They're not as good, obviously. Mm-hmm. They taste better. But if you do seem like you have a lot of problems, if you can pick them, you know, when they're a little green yet, they don't seem to get that during that period. So, you know, sometimes that kind of helps too.
All right, sounds good. Let's go to line four. We have a call from Geneva. Good morning. You're on the air with Sandy Mason.
Good morning, people. How is everybody?
Great.
Pretty good.
You know, I've actually done pretty good with my tomatoes and my bell pepper plants and all that this year. It must be, you know, because of the heat. But I'm already picking tomatoes off the vine. So
oh, great!
It worked out. But my question is actually kind of an environmentally type question. With this heat, these extraordinary heat waves that we've been getting all across the country, is this a climate cause thing, or is this a cycle, or what? And can we expect more of that throughout this summer? You know?
Wow, I don't really know. We'd have to get Ed Kieser in here. I don't know if he'd probably be much more intelligent sounding than I ever would on those kind of things. So I'm really not sure I can really answer that too much, to be honest with you. I think it is interesting, you know, as we look at a lot of the plants that we have, that some of them do better. Some actually will do better during those kind of conditions, and others will do worse. And so I guess it's one of those things where, with a gardener, you just have to be kind of open.
Well, I've been looking at especially up here, putting in more drought-tolerant, sure, and heat-resistant type plants. I know my folks live in California. They live in the desert. They're talking about heat. They live in Lancaster, which is kind of like Phoenix, but they have gotten so bad out there with the water situation. We all laugh and cry about the gasoline prices, but they're paying through it now with water. The Colorado River is exceptionally low, and so is a lot of the lakes out there. But what I've been doing is kind of taking up from what they do down there, basically, is trying to put in more drought-tolerant plants around the house, and that way I don't get scolded by my wife, yep, to water the darn plants.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. I think the more that we can do that and have these drought-tolerant plants, or even just the methods like mulching or, you know, some of these other methods that we have, so when we do water, even drip irrigation, you know, we're much more efficient at it when we do irrigate. So I think you bring up a good point, and maybe this is a reminder to all of us that no matter where you live, it's time to start thinking about those kind of things.
Thank you very much.
Uh-huh. All right. Thanks for your call. Uh-huh. And our guest this morning on the first hour of Focus is Sandy Mason, Unit Educator of Horticulture and Environment with the University of Illinois Extension. So if you have a question about your flowers or your garden, or do you get into lawn care at all?
Sure.
All right. We'll do that, too. Give us a call at 333-9455, or if you're outside the 217 area code, 800-222-9455. And let's go to line two. We have a call from White Heath. Good morning. You're on the air with Sandy Mason.
Thank you. Do you get into trees?
Sure.
Okay. I have a mock crab apple, or whatever they call it, and it's quite a large tree, and it's got a lot of suckers on the branches. Should I leave those, just leave them?
You mean at the base of the tree it produces?
No, on the branches of the tree. It's just filled with suckers.
Yeah, where they're just kind of coming up straight,
yeah,
and all
over the place.
Yeah, it's a good idea to get rid of those for any number of reasons. It tends to be, you know, it just makes the plant more full and takes up a lot of space. And usually those are not ones that flower, which is generally what we want with the crab apples anyway, is uh-huh, good flowering. So you want to get rid of those. And often what you find, I don't know if you've done any pruning in the past, but often what you find is that those suckers come up from old pruning areas, you know, where you've pruned in the past,
yeah,
and then you get all these suckers coming up. So you generally, one thing is to do is that generally go ahead and cut those off. But then when you do prune, you may not want to do just heavy pruning all at one time. If you can do sort of regular pruning, like every year, do a little bit of pruning, then
okay,
you don't get quite that big flush of suckering either at the,
yeah,
base or at the pruning wounds. But they just do that. You know, apples and crab apples just have a tendency to do that. But to answer your question, yes, they go ahead and take those off.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Thanks a lot.
Sure.
Bye.
I also heard that those suckers and things like around your trees are pulling nutrients that you really want for your main tree. Is that true or not true?
It is one of those things where they generally, as I said, they generally don't flower. They generally just end up like they're taking up a lot of space, mm-hmm, and not really helping out necessarily a whole lot. And it's probably a lot of its aesthetics, too. They just, mm-hmm, don't look quite as nice. So it is one of those things that for a lot of the crab apples, and you'll see a few other trees just have a tendency to do that, where they send up suckers.
Okay. Let's go to line one. We have a caller from Mattoon. Good morning. You're on the air with Sandy Mason.
Good morning. I have a couple of questions. One, this spring I planted a number of onion sets, red and white and yellow, in raised rows. And I've been harvesting, and it's really been a disappointment. They just didn't seem to get big at all. I didn't know whether it was because I had raised the rows and stuck them, mm-hmm, in, which I thought was the thing to do,
mm-hmm,
maybe the weather. I did, mm-hmm, get that cool spell after I'd planted them.
So when did you plant them?
I think it was about in March.
Okay. So that part's good. And were they particularly big sets?
It varied. I bought them, mm-hmm, at a local store, and I tried to pick out the largest ones,
yeah,
to plant, and it's just been disappointing this year. As a matter of fact, last year wasn't so good either. Most of them are not much bigger than golf balls.
Right.
Usually they're a little larger, and I wondered if it's just lack of fertilizer, or is a raised row not the thing to do?
Actually, the raised, when you say raised row, they're just, it's just kind of a mound, and then they're kind of in the...
Pull up, make a row higher than the ground, and then stick in the...
Right,
the
which
plant.
Should be just fine. Actually, onions are a little bit different. You know, typically we would think, you know, if you were picking tulip bulbs or any of the flowering bulbs, we'd always say bigger is better. Onions are a little bit different. You're actually better if you get some of the smaller ones than the real big ones. Which sounds funny, I know, but it truly works out with onions. They actually will grow bigger because of the way they end up growing. And you do, and you planted them early, so that's good. So that you need to get them in early, which you got, and then you may be just getting almost too big of sets.
Well, the same thing happened to my garlic. Only I planted it in October,
right?
And in raised rows, I had one row of elephant garlic, and then one row of the smaller kind that's a little stronger. And this year, normally I get a real good crop of them.
Right.
This year, they're smaller, too, and I just wondered if it's maybe I should have fertilized more.
Well, if you have halfway decent soil, I'm not sure that's the issue. Certainly compost, you know, adding a lot of organic matter or that kind of thing is going to help.
In the fall, when they popped up, they looked really good, and I put a lot of leaves around them for the winter months.
Right, with your garlic.
And then I think possibly that cold spell that we had might have damaged some of the, not the elephant garlic, but the other kind.
Right,
I'd never had that happen before.
Right.
Is that a possibility?
Yeah, that's certainly a possibility, but usually they pop out. I mean, it's not enough that kills them. They usually go ahead and pop out of that fairly quickly, even though the green leaves, you know, because a lot of times they already have the green leaves on them and everything, and all that just gets killed off or kind of killed off, but it doesn't kill the whole bulb. So they usually
planted,
go ahead and
a couple of rows of green beans and raised rows again, and they've done very well. So I just didn't think it was the fertilization.
I don't think that's really the case. And then did they have some regular water then early in the season? You know, some areas were fairly dry early, and some of them
weren't. It's a possibility on the garlic. I didn't really water it all that much.
Yeah.
I thought maybe I'd heard someplace that you don't really need to water the garlic as much as some other things.
Right, and absolutely. You don't need to water them nearly as much. But we had, 6 weeks or so there where we just really didn't have any moisture at all. That's what I really wondered, too.
Well, I did water them occasionally. I have one other question. They're talking about that blossom rot on tomatoes. I've had a similar problem. Isn't there some sort of spray, a calcium spray of some kind that you could spray on the lower leaves or something that might help?
There is a product. You can spray calcium nitrate. But I will tell you, we have a lot of mixed results about those, and so I'm not real big on recommending them. And you do have to spray them when the tomatoes are about grape size. And so if they're bigger than grape size, it doesn't help. So there's some, you know, it's certainly something if somebody wants to try it, they can. I've just had a lot of mixed, comments from people that they didn't think it really helped all that terribly much.
Well, so, I'd wondered if I'd heard that sometimes if you spray it, it might cut down the size of the crop, that they might not bloom and
with the calcium nitrate
and produce more.
Oh, that they would produce more?
Would not.
Oh, would not produce more.
If you spray too much.
Well, you certainly don't want to spray too much, obviously. But it's really because it's the calcium is the problem that causes the blossom end rot problem. But so much of it has to do with the environment on whether the plant's taking it up or not. And so that's why we spray it on there. But again, it has to be when the tomatoes are grape size or smaller. So they have to be small. And a lot of times we don't start them until, you know, we already see the problem. And so sometimes it doesn't really help all that much.
It's more the weather than the heat and the lack of calcium in the ground.
Right. The calcium is there in the ground. But the problem is because it's so humid, the plant quits taking up enough calcium. It just quits, you know, kind of just shuts down. When it's hot and humid, they kind of just shut down, and so it's not taking up enough calcium, and then those fruits need a lot of calcium. And then they're just not taking it up. And so it's in the soil. It's just because of the mechanics of the plant, it's just in the weather and all that kind of stuff, they're just not taking it up. And so that's the idea. You spray it on the fruit, you know, because that's where it needs it. But again, it has to be when the fruit's really small.
So it should be, if you're spraying, you want to get them when they're small.
Yep, yep. They have to be about grape size.
Okay.
So they're small when you're spraying them. And those that can help. But I think you're better off, again, using mulch and, you know, trying to keep a consistent moisture and all those kinds of things.
One other thing on the mulch. Somebody said you could put newspapers around your tomato plant.
Sure. Absolutely. You probably want to put something on top of them because they tend to dry and all that kind of stuff. But it's fine if you want to put, you know, just, you know, wet newspaper and then put, like, I don't know, grass clippings or compost or whatever on top of that. It's a great way to cut down on weeds. It's, you know, it decomposes, helps the soil. So, sure, you can do that.
So the ink in the newspapers wouldn't be any kind of a problem.
No, it's they're all soy-based now. We're still a little bit, there's still a lot of debate now on the slick papers that have the colored inks. And so there's still, to be cautious, and we're probably being overcautious, to not use the slick papers, which are kind of hard to use anyway. You know, the ads and stuff that have the color sheets. Not to use those, but then all the other papers are just fine.
Okay, thank
you.
Sure.
All right, thanks for your call. Let's go to line three. We have a caller from Champaign. Good morning. You're on the air with Sandy Mason.
Well, the creeping Charlie phenomenon continues. So I was thinking of even getting a blowtorch or a flamethrower.
It likes this weather, doesn't it? Hot, dry, it's fine.
You know, it's, as I sleep, it just continues.
You have nightmares, do you?
You know, I thought maybe if I kept an eye on it, it would be embarrassed, but it just doesn't. It actually developed, I bought the house a couple years ago, and, you know, of course, when I moved in, I had all kinds of other problems, like renovation.
Yeah.
So now I've turned some attention toward the lawn. I think you'd mentioned it's probably only maybe 50 feet long, maybe, I don't know, 10 feet wide. In terms of digging it up, is that, you have to get every root? What happens there? The other one is that there's a lot of clay and stuff, and I'd have to put dirt in, you know, some black dirt in anyway, you know. So I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I guess a couple of that. You're absolutely right in the sense that you really do need to get up all the roots because they, you know, they send out these runners.
Yeah.
And those, of course, if you don't get them, they just root and, you know, do their thing. So you do need, but you can do a pretty good job because the roots aren't terribly deep. They're not like a lot of weeds that we have. So the roots aren't terribly deep. So you could do a pretty good job if you want to take the time, certainly, to go ahead and just dig it up that way. The other thing I wonder about is you were saying you need to add soil anyway, your comment. And I don't know how much, depending on, you know, how much you need to bring it up or whatever, but one thing you might try, and actually I had fairly good luck with this, is something called lasagna gardening. And I think I've talked about this maybe in the past, but what you do is you actually do the whole, and you can do any number of layers that you want to, but I've done this, actually I did this with a strawberry bed that got taken over with Creeping Charlie, and I just got tired of fighting the whole thing, so I decided I was just going to renovate it. And so actually what you do is you take wet newspaper, you put several layers of wet newspaper, and then you put like peat moss, and you put several inches of peat moss, and then you put some soil on top of that, you put shredded leaves, you just kind of do like you're making lasagna kind of thing. And it really did a very good job of just smothering out the Creeping Charlie. I didn't have to spray it. I didn't have to do anything with it. So if you don't mind, you know, bringing it up a few inches, you could just decide you just want to smother this stuff out.
Well, that's because it's a lot of clay at this point. So it's having a field day over there.
Right, because the grass isn't growing. So that's why it's good to get something like this lasagna gardening or something so that you have, you know, some good organic matter in there so that the grass is going to grow better.
Gee, I was getting ready to eat when you said lasagna.
A few tomatoes. So you might try just smothering it.
I like that.
Out.
Now, would you do that in the fall? Is that the idea or not?
You could do it whenever you want to. You could actually do it now if you wanted to. It generally is going to take a season. You know, you could certainly do it now, and then maybe next spring you could, you know, seed your lawn, maybe do something along those lines if you want to. But it obviously takes a little while for all that stuff to decompose, and then it actually sinks too because as things decompose, they sink a little bit, so you get back to your...
And then one final question. In regard to, unfortunately, there was a nice tree back there, but the previous owner decided that it was a problem getting into her above-ground pool, so she took it out. I'm dealing, unfortunately, with you know, the stumps and you know, and all that kind of stuff. Is there any way to sort of take care of that? You know, or you know, what's the mold or whatever? What's that? Like mushrooms or whatever that stuff is that develops on top of it in certain sections.
Okay, so you're getting mushrooms coming up from it. Is it is the tree just sending up suckers too, or is it pretty well dead?
No, it's pretty dead, but it's aggravating.
With the mushrooms coming up?
Yeah, and, you know, you run over it with a lawnmower. Luckily, it's not an expensive lawnmower, so, you know, you know, when it destroys it, I just go out and buy another one.
Okay.
Is there any solution there? Or, you know, can you, it's decaying is what's happening, right?
Yeah, and that's, and unfortunately, anything you could do to speed that up is obviously going to help. Oh. You know, if you can, you know, I don't know if there's a stump that's actually still visible, but any way that you can sort of break that up and make that smaller or get part of that out or whatever. So anyway, anything you can do to help encourage that decaying process is going to, you know, get this whole process moving faster. So you certainly can try that. And unfortunately, really isn't a whole lot you can do. The mushrooms will just pop up. But that's what, you know, they're supposed to be doing. They're supposed to be decaying the wood.
It's not another job for layering.
No, you could try that. Actually, you could try that. You know, that certainly would help the whole decaying thing.
You know,
would notice the mushrooms.
One solution, you know, you try to apply it to many.
That's right. There you go. And mushrooms with your lasagna, hey, how could you go wrong?
Okay, thanks a lot.
Sure.
Thank you very much for your call. Let's go to line four. We have a call from Belgium. Good morning. You're on the air with Sandy Mason.
Good morning. I know you don't usually deal with the things in the wildlife as much as you do gardens, but I've noticed a real problem with one of my favorite things, and that's raspberries. This year, the raspberry crop out in the wild, where you just go to the brambles and pick them, which I've been going to for 30, 40 years now, same brambles, they're getting very, very small. There was... The fruit turned red, but didn't turn black hardly at all. Very little fruit. Now, that might have had to do with frost and the dry weather and stuff.
That's what I was going to mention. It wasn't a good year for raspberries and stuff because of the frost.
Yeah, but there's also another problem, too, and I don't know if you've noticed it with domestic varieties. The fruit will turn red and start towards ripening, and then it'll stop, and it just like it, something is eating it from the inside and turns all the little berries brown. They just shrivel up and go brown.
Yeah.
I don't think I got a pint off of acres of berry brambles this year.
Yeah. Well, this year, certainly the frost had part to do with that, but they do get some disease problems, and I wonder if you're not seeing a few disease problems cropping up in there. Because certainly the wild ones can get disease problems, too.
Yeah.
That certainly might. They also get, have you noticed anything on the foliage at all? They do get a couple of viruses
that
certainly can cause some issues, but usually you'll also see something on the leaves as they look distorted or they're stunted or something.
I have noticed that there's very few canes. The canes, you know how you go into the bramble and the best thing to do is go and pick the berries and you tromp the brambles down as much as you can because the canes will grow back up from those again, okay? And in future years, you'll have a nice berry patch more and more. But this anymore, it seems like very few of the canes seem to survive.
Oh, they're not even making it.
Yeah.
Well, do get a disease called anthracnose, which I don't know if you want to look at some of the canes.
Yeah.
This may be more involved than you ever want to do with wild kinds of fruit.
No.
But you might just look at the canes because they do get a thing called anthracnose, and it'll show up as these canker-like things on the stems themselves. And so you may be seeing some of that because they certainly, even in the wild ones, they can get that. And it might be, again, this may be a lot more than you ever want to do with the wild stuff, but it might be good just to get some of that stuff cleaned out, or maybe at least in part of it, and that might be one way to sort of help the crop along.
Now, this anthracnose, is that the same one that affects sycamore trees and all?
They're both called anthracnose, but it's actually it's a different fungus. It's a similar fungus, but it's not the same fungus.
Okay, because I was going to say, a lot of times there's a lot of sycamore trees in these areas, and I thought maybe there might be some interplay there or something.
No, it's same name, but I know it's a little confusing, but it's actually a little different variety of fungus. It's attacking these guys.
I see. Thank you very much, ma'am.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Thanks for your call. Hey, it's 10:30. We're at the halfway point in the first hour of Focus 580, and Our guest this morning is Sandy Mason. Sandy is a frequent flyer here at Focus 580. How long have you been doing this?
Since 1992,
is that
I
right?
figured. Wow.
Dispensing. Dispensing good advice, I should say. Sandy is unit educator of horticulture and environment with the University of Illinois Extension. If you have a question for Sandy, you can call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Let's go to line two, Urbana. Good morning. You're on the air.
Yes, hello. We're trying to figure out if an ash tree of ours has the borers or possibly a wilt or something like that. It's getting, the leaves seem to be kind of like crinkling up, you know, so they're not like flat, but mm-hmm. just kind of a wavy kind of effect on the end. And they'll be starting to brown, you know, from the edges moving mm-hmm. inward. Not the whole leaf, but we get plenty of, we get, you know, quite a few brown leaves falling.
Mm-hmm.
Not a lot. I've noticed a few holes in the bark, but not too many. You know, what kind of thing do we look for? Is that looking like that's what it is? Or
mm-hmm. Now, where are you located?
On Meyer Ridge in Urbana.
Okay, you're in Urbana. And are you noticing dieback of the branches themselves at all?
No.
I mean, does it just like not, part of it just doesn't leaf out? And how old is this tree?
Oh, well, it's pretty big. Large tree, so okay. It's pretty old. I don't know how old. Nothing from the outside of the tree mm-hmm. is dying back, but on the inside, there's a lot more, you know, dead limbs, mm-hmm. stuff like that. And we've mm-hmm. heard that borers usually cause a tree to die from the top down. That's not seeming to be what's happening.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like that.
More inside stuff.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, so when you say you're seeing these holes, about how big are the holes?
No, there's no holes in the leaves.
Oh, I thought you said holes in the trunk and the bark?
Oh, in the
Did
trunk.
Did I miss that?
Yes, the trunk. I have a measure zoom.
I'm laughing because, of course, you haven't measured. I mean, you probably wouldn't notice that.
I'm trying to even imagine what they are without
yeah,
maybe
that's fine.
No more than a 16th of an inch, okay. Maybe an eighth.
Okay. Okay. It doesn't sound like typical, you know, we're obviously worried about the emerald ash borer, which is one of the borers that's taking out a lot of trees, certainly in the northern part of the United States and eastern. I guess a couple things is there actually is a very nice website, if you have web access, on emerald ash borer. And I think it's just emerald ash borer info. Something like that, but I'm sure if you Google that, you'll end up with some really good information. And it has good pictures, and we actually have pictures in our office as well on what to look for, because it's very distinctive. The size of the holes are much smaller than we typically would see with other ash borers, because unfortunately ash trees do get other borers, but typically those are much bigger. And the ones from emerald ash borer actually are D-shaped, D as in dog, okay. Like capital D, and they're smaller. So the look is a little bit different. So there are a few differences there. We probably might be seeing actually dieback of the branches, but it's always good just to check. I mean, just to find out. I mean, because you never know. And that's how pretty much all these trees have been found, certainly in Illinois. It's just, you know, homeowners just being observant and, you know, looking at for these things. So it's a good idea to check. I guess on the leaves themselves, they do get, and I know I'm going to confuse everybody again, because ash also get a thing called anthracnose. It's similar to what sycamores get, but not quite the same thing. It is a fungus. And it does cause some browning on the outside of the leaf. And then as the leaf tries to expand, it kind of crinkles. It because it can't, that tissue's dead, and so it can't really expand very well, and so you get this kind of distorted leaf with a little browning on the outside edge. Typically, we don't worry about that too much because it's too late now to worry about it because it's an early infection thing anyway, and it's generally not life-threatening for the tree. So ash trees get several different things that could be going on, but overall, it sounds like this tree maybe is fairly healthy, or you're just concerned that it...
Oh, yeah, it's a, you know, gorgeous tree, and we don't want to lose it.
Right.
And we're noticing all these, you know, leaves crinkling up, you know, almost like they're starved of water or something.
Okay. You might want to bring in some samples, maybe to our office or at the U of I Plant Clinic on St. Mary's Road.
To be honest, we tried that, and the lady tried real hard and figure out what it was. And she was kind of on the thing, it was either the ash borer or a wilt. She did notice like a little webbing on the leaf and some little things in there, but I don't know. I didn't get a sense that she was really sure sure about.
Well, and it might be something where you might want to go ahead and take it to the U of I plant clinic there on St. Mary's Road. You certainly could do that as well. And just kind of take a look, you know, have somebody take a look at it just to be on the safe side. You might take pictures of those holes, you know, maybe with a pencil or something next to it so people have an idea what size they are. Maybe look at that website and just get a little educated on those things. But really with all these things, for the most part, our best bet is just to try to keep the trees healthy as best we can. I don't know if you haven't mulched. I realize it's a fairly large tree, but even on large trees, you know, if you can mulch underneath them, that can help. You know, just 2 or 3 inches of a good wood chip mulch is fine. And just try to keep them healthy. You know, if you can water during drought periods, that's great.
Yeah, because we
it really helps.
Yeah, we tried that borer systemic,
Oh, yeah.
Last fall, and then, you know, obviously we're still having a problem, so I don't know.
Yeah, that systemic is, if it's the one I'm thinking of, that's an insecticide, so that's going to help against insects. It's not going to help necessarily against what I think this might be, which is a fungus.
Okay.
So it wouldn't help against that. There may be some other systemics out there, but that's the one I'm familiar with. It's just strictly an insecticide. So, you know, you may want to do that. I'm going to be in the office the rest of the week, certainly. If you want to bring a sample by, I'd be glad to take a look at it for you, too.
Okay, great.
Uh-huh.
All right, thanks.
Uh-huh, good luck.
Thanks very much for your call. Let's go to line one, caller from Champaign. Good morning. You're on the air with Sandy Mason.
Thank you. Sandy, we recently lost a hedge, a shrub, I'm not exactly sure what the technical difference is, to some over-enthusiastic landscapers. we asked them to cut back. It was providing a lot of privacy, but some family members thought that it had overgrown and so forth and needed to be cut back. So it's basically killed. And so what we're looking for is something that's going to be about maybe 6-8 feet of width or multiple plantings, and will eventually provide us 6-8 feet of height for privacy with the neighbors. And the constraint is that it has to be tolerant to very low levels of light. It's kind of behind a tree, and I was wondering if there's something you could recommend.
So does it get any sun at all, or
it gets about I'm guessing 2 hours a day because of the geometry of the neighbor's house and the trees and so on and so forth.
Well, there actually are some great viburnums out there, which I don't know, you know, if you're too familiar with viburnums. And
I'm not. And could you spell that for me?
It's a V as in Victor.
I.
B as in boy. U R. Viburnum.
N-U-M.
N-U-M.
Right. N-U-M. Viburnum and Bailey. Okay.
Viburnum and... Hey, there you go. All right. Thought about that. But the one thing with viburnums, there's a gazillion of them, but I don't think I've ever met one I didn't like, so that's a good thing. There is one that's called Arrowwood Viburnum, which actually is a native viburnum.
Okay.
And it does... and actually grows in forested areas.
Oh,
so it's you know... And most of the viburnums are somewhat shade tolerant. I think what you'll notice with some of them... they may have a little bit more tendency to open up, as in not be quite as thick. And that's why you may periodically want to do a little pruning on them. But I think with most of them, I really haven't had any problems with too much of that. So Arrowwood might be a nice one. They do get some fruit on them, a nice blue, kind of blue-black fruit with a white flower.
Okay, is this something I could get at a local place like Prairie Garden or something like that?
Yeah, pretty much all the garden centers are going to have different types of viburnums. But you just need to really do some checking and really look and see how big they're going to get, because some of them can actually get quite large, 15, 16 feet.
Oh, wow.
So you really want to, do a little homework, see which ones that you're really looking at, which ones you like. And there's a bunch of them out there.
Okay, beautiful. And one last quick question. We have a little, tiny little cedar tree that's about 6 feet tall that the previous owners of the house planted way too close to our deck. And it's going to have to be moved. Is there anything you can tell us about the light needs of a little cedar tree? Can we plant it somewhere in full light, or can we plant it in full shade, or anything like that?
Well, they actually do better if they have sun.
Okay.
Plenty of sun and plenty of air circulation, that kind of thing.
So, all right, thank you. Thank you so much.
Sure.
All right, thanks very much for your call. Let's go to line three. We have a caller from McLean County. Good morning. You're on the air with Sandy Mason.
Good morning. I was just wondering some curious questions about garlic and onions again. And my husband had planted just basically onion to have green onions and had too many and left some in, and they've and I don't know when to harvest them. It's because we've never grown onions, and it's a really strange thing.
So when were they planted?
Early May. Yeah, we didn't get in earlier than that because I know their green onions are really for early spring. They're a spring.
Right.
Right. Yeah, and he ate as many as he could, and then let the rest go.
Good for him.
The stems are starting to turn brown.
Then I'd go ahead and harvest them.
Okay.
And what you'll find is they probably aren't going to give you a bulb of any sort. You know, it might be a little bit of swelling, but they're really not going to be much of a bulb. And just kind of use them like you might scallions or something like that.
Okay.
But no, I would go ahead. Once they start to yellow up like that, usually it's a good sign it's time to go.
Okay. And we have elephant garlic, and this is something I have not yet figured out how to do that. Harvest them, actually.
Mm-hmm.
I was told by the friend who gave this to us that we should dig them up in June and replant them. Like, you put them in the first year, then you dig them up in June, then you replant them in August, end of August, and then the next year they'll be ready. Is that so far correct?
Unless they're just trying to get bigger ones, I don't know why they're replanting it. So you're replanting the same ones?
Yeah, and see, I cheat. I don't dig them up. And the thing is, what happens is some of them will split into several stems.
Mm-hmm.
So then I know they have to dig them up and replant those. But the ones that remain in one stem, I don't replant those or don't dig them up. And last year we did dig them up and hung them and then replanted them the year before. Last year we replanted them. We ended up with tons of them.
Mm-hmm.
And so this year, some of them only have one stem. So I'm going to leave them because they should be ready. Because what happens, and I've tried them, if you take them out like this year, if they only have one stem, they'll be actually a form of a bulb. They're
mm-hmm.
not formed into the actual garlic.
Mm-hmm.
So apparently they really do take 2 years. It's just that I cannot seem to figure out the cycle. How do I know what and when? Any clues on that? And the other question, let me go ahead and ask you this so I won't forget, is the garlic that looks ornamental,
mm-hmm.
There's no bulb for them, is there?
The garlic that looks ornamental, as
yeah,
in?
A friend of mine gave me some ornamental garlic where they had this twirly little bulb, the flower that comes up, and I don't know if there's any bulb to it or not. And it got mixed up with our elephant garlic. And I let those flower. I didn't take the flowers off. I should have done it just to see if there would be a bulb growing underneath or not.
So are you talking about ornamental onions?
No, garlic.
Like society garlic?
I have no idea.
What's the name of it?
All she called them was ornamental garlic. And they had this beautiful curly, where the flower comes up, comes a beautiful curly stem. It looks very pretty. And when the flowers actually bloom, the stem straightens out. But, since I can't give you the answer to that one, let's go back to elephant garlic.
Yeah.
Only because I don't know, and my friend isn't around to help me find out the name of it either, because she's giving me all kinds of stuff, and I have no idea what I have as long as it looks good, you know?
Right, right, right. Yeah, I'm not sure what she's calling ornamental garlic. I mean, it could be an ornamental onion, but that's beside the point. And so with the elephant garlic, even though it's not really, because elephant garlic really isn't a type of garlic, it's really an onion.
Okay.
And I didn't realize it took 2 years either, to be honest with you. So I think I'm going to have to do a little check-in. I mean, normally I would just go ahead and plant it like we typically did with garlic, where you plant them in October and you harvest them in July. But you're saying that they're telling you to replant the same ones. And the only thing I can think of is just the size.
Uh-huh.
You know, by replanting them, then you're planting a bigger size.
Okay. All right.
But beyond that, I don't know why else you'd want to.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's what he has said. And in the past, I've done that. What I've done is, like I said, if I have one stem, I won't even dig it up. But when there are many stems, then you have to dig them up and replant those.
Right.
And then those will take 2 years. It's a really crazy way to grow those garlic. But anyway,
I'm going to have to do some checking because I really don't know about that, to be honest with you.
Okay.
Well,
that sounds good. And let me ask you one last question. This is really, I feel embarrassed because I have a voice my friends recognize. So they won't know, like, I heard you again on WLL. Anyway, is there any way to find fruit trees that are fungi resistant or insect resistant? Are there trees available? Because we have two apple trees, and one of them we're going to have to cut down because every single year it gets so many bugs. I'm lucky if I can even take one cut in half or even a fourth to eat it.
Right, right.
And then, of course, the reason we decided to cut it down now is because of Japanese beetles.
Right.
Because they will clean out the leaves completely.
Right. Well, you know, I don't know about Japanese beetle issues because they're all pretty much going to get that one way or the other. But there are certainly apple trees that are much more disease resistant than some of the other ones. And actually, some of them were developed in Illinois. There's actually a new one called Juliet that actually shows some really good promise as far as being disease resistant. There's Prima and Priscilla. I think there's several of them that have come out of a Purdue Rutgers Illinois program. So there's certainly some of them out there that are much more disease resistant. Now, I'm not sure I've heard anything as far as Japanese beetle resistance, but certainly you can take care of some of the other disease problems by doing that. And we have, actually, I think there's some on the U of I Extension website where you can find, you know, those particular varieties, or otherwise give me a call and I'd be glad to search those out for you. We have some fact sheets on that as well.
Okay. All right. Great.
Because
I hate to give up my trees.
Yeah. And maybe in the meantime, I'll figure out about that elephant garlic thing.
Right. Thanks very much for your call this
Thanks.
Morning. Sandy Mason from the U of I Extension is our guest this morning. Let's go to line four. We have a call from Vermilion County. Good morning. You're on the air with Sandy Mason.
Good morning. I have three short, unrelated questions, at least the first two are. My lettuce is probably at its largest right now. I keep expecting it to bolt, but it hasn't.
Hmm.
If I want to keep getting lettuce as long as I can, would I be better to keep taking the side leaves off, or should I start taking out of the top, or does it matter?
And it still hasn't gotten bitter on you?
Well, it's beginning to, but you know, it's green.
Yeah, usually by now it's starting to get bitter or it's starting to bolt, and so usually by now people have pretty well harvested the whole thing. If it's not getting better, there's certainly no reason why you can't just continue to harvest the outside edge. Or some people do that cut and come again. Is this leaf lettuce? I assume
lettuce.
Some kind. Yeah, where you just cut it off. You know, just cut off the whole thing and then let it come back.
Oh,
and you can certainly do that.
I don't know if I'll do that, but
yeah, and you can certainly do that, and so that might be one thing.
It has a stalk now, almost like a broccoli stalk.
Oh, on that, yeah.
I mean, it's probably 18 inches tall.
Wow.
And I've been just taking off side leaves, so now that, you know, it's a bare stem for about almost a foot, maybe 10 inches.
Wow, and it still tastes good. Go figure.
Well, it's not what it was this spring, but, you know, it'll do on a sandwich.
That's right. Well, mustard, who knows? No, I think that's fine. But, with that one, I don't know. I think I would just continue with what you have now and just assume that very soon you're not going to have anything. It's going to bolt, and it sounds like it's getting ready to anyway, but it's starting to produce that big of a stem.
Okay, second question. My basil seems to be at its prime,
mm-hmm.
starting to make flowers. It's been making flowers. I've been picking them off. Are those flowers edible?
Are the flowers edible?
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh, sure.
Okay.
Sure.
And would I be better to just take off big top parts of the branches, like cutting it back to harvest it, rather than just taking, you know, a leaf here and a branch there? In other words, like shorten it by half?
You certainly can do that. They're very good at branching out.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you've had coleus or any of the other ones where we actually would pinch back a whole branch.
I've not done anything.
Okay. You can actually just go ahead and pinch them back, and you can actually make it smaller and use more of the branches that way or more of the leaves that way without having to take off individual leaves. And so you just do these, you know, from the stems themselves, you're just going to go back, and you want to leave, you know, at least a couple of nodes, you know, where the leaves are coming out. You'd want to leave a couple of those on that particular branch, but you can take them back pretty severely, and they'll branch out and do the whole thing all over again.
So leave the height and just take from the sides?
But also from the top too.
Okay.
Just I assume it has multiple branches at this point.
Yes.
Okay. So each one of those branches you can just take cuttings off of.
Okay.
You know, we actually shorten them, and so the whole plant's going to be smaller.
Okay.
But just leave a couple of nodes at least, you know, a couple of leaves that are coming out, and then those will send out new branches, and then you'll just keep going that way.
I've been faking it for years as to how to harvest it. Okay. Last question. Getting lower on energy, I have basic things like hoes and rakes and stuff like that,
mm-hmm.
The two or three little hand tools. But is there any kind of thing that I might consider getting for a birthday present that's helpful in terms of not having to expend so much physical energy in gardening?
There's actually some great hand tools now. Everything from, actually some of them have new kind of ratchet systems, you know, like with their pruners and stuff, so you don't have to use so much energy, as in you don't have to grip so hard. And those are really nice. I love those new pruners. There's actually some new ergonomic type of tools that are much better on your wrist. They put a lot of the strength and all that stuff. It goes into some of your bigger muscles, like your shoulder and stuff like that, so you don't tire as easily. And for a lot of us with, you know, carpal tunnel syndrome kind of thing, there's lots of new ones like that that really help you, you know, not to aggravate that particular problem. So there's all kinds of new tools, which are really good, which I really like them.
Okay, but there isn't one or two like you'd get that first sort of.
Well, I always, to me, I use my pruners the most, my hand pruners the most. Okay. So to me, that would be the one thing. I'd find a good set of those with some of these, the ratchet systems, and they'll actually, you know, obviously they're going to promote that in the information that they have, but it, you don't have to grip as hard.
Okay.
Thank All right. You. Thanks very much for your call. Let's go to line two. We have a caller from Lafayette. Good morning. You're on the air with Sandy Mason.
Hello. Could I ask about grass?
Sure.
Mine largely lies down in hot weather, and the only way I can get the mower to stand up, get it to stand up to the mower, is to rake it backward against the grain, and pretty soon it's falling down again and hard to cut.
Mm-hmm. So what kind of, how tall do you let it get before you mow it normally?
Three and a half inches.
Okay. And then what kind of grass is this? A real shady type grass? Or
Some of it is. Some of it's bluegrass and fine. But there's some considerable fescue, and both of them do it.
Of the fine fescue? The fine leaf fescue?
No, some of it's pretty coarse compared to the bluegrass.
And even at that, it lays down. I guess I just I wonder about maybe not letting it get quite so tall. I mean, it's good to let it get taller, especially when it's when it's dry like this. But to have it, I'm not sure I've ever heard that problem before, unless it's just getting too tall. Or with some of the, certainly some of the fine leaf fescues and some of those in shady spots, they have a tendency to need a little bit shorter mowing because they have a tendency to flop even more. So, and it seems pretty healthy otherwise, you know, fertilizer and all that.
It does.
Yeah, you may want to try that. Or you may even want to try a different, you know, I don't know if you mow in the same direction every single time.
I keep changing so it doesn't keep lying in the same direction.
Yeah, because sometimes that can obviously help too. So beyond that, and beyond just, it's not just like really, really dry or anything like that, that might also cause it to lay down.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Thanks a lot for your call. We have about 3 minutes or so left in the program. Let's go to line one and Spring Bay. Good morning. You're on the air with Sandy Mason.
Good morning. Just a little bit more on the garlic. I'm not an expert, but I grow about 12 varieties, and we got about 3,000 bulbs hanging, curing now. And we try to harvest when we've got five green leaves left on the plant for the top-setting hardneck garlics. And garlic, we figure, needs about an inch of rain a week to form up good-sized bulbs. And this spring, it was pretty rough on them because we had that drought, and so the bulb sizes are a little smaller.
Okay, well, that's good to know. Maybe that other person's listening.
And then the other caller about the ornamental garlic, it sounds like that's a top-setting garlic, a hardneck, and those, we break those off. We pop the tops off of those when they get to be about 10 inches long after the curl has formed, and that sends the energy back down into the bulb to form it up, so.
Yeah, it almost sounded like that's they were growing it for the top. Yeah, I'm with you. Normally we would just pop those off, and actually sometimes people eat those things, but I've never heard of anybody actually calling that ornamental and promoting it. So
we sent a lot over to a local Italian restaurant this spring, and they cooked them up, and we're offering them as a special with some nice white sauce. And
sounds good. Lovely. Anything in a good white sauce. Oh, good. So have you grown elephant garlic then?
No, we don't do that.
Okay.
I believe is a shallot.
Yeah, it's not true. Not a really a garlic. I do know that part, but oh, okay. Well, that's
we
okay,
just
well,
do
good.
the regular garlic and market gardening.
Okay, great, great. Well, thanks for the info.
Yep.
All right, thanks a lot. What, do we have about 2-3 minutes left? Let's get one more call in. Let's go to line 3 and Watsika. We have a... Hi there.
Hello.
Hi, we have just a couple of minutes if
okay.
you have a quick question.
Okay, this is an oak leaf hydrangea question. Last October, I planted some oak leaf hydrangeas along the foundation of my house, and... They're the peewee ones, mm-hmm. they're the little ones, and they're doing great. I had to temporarily move one just this past July 2nd to allow access to my crawl space. And I moved it, I tried to leave the root ball in place,
mm-hmm.
and I wrapped it with a towel, and I slid cardboard underneath, and I put it into a large pot, and then I packed with holes, and I packed the pot with moistened peat moss,
mm-hmm.
and I put this in a garden cart so I can easily move it to keep it in the coolest place so it spins day by day. It's in my utility room, and by night I put it outside.
Mm-hmm. What's your question real quick, because we have to go here a second.
Okay, my question is... should I really be concerned about getting it back into the ground, or should I really wait until the temperature moderates before I put it back? I keep it well hydrated.
Mm. Okay, thanks a lot.
Yeah, I really think my feeling is to get it in the ground. I mean, it sounds like it's tender, loving care. I mean, you've given it wonderful care. But I think your best bet in the long run is to get it in the ground and get it into that kind of a situation so we can start regrowing.
All right. Thanks a lot. Sandy, we really appreciate it.
Thank you.
You being here. You're going to be back again, I guess, next month.
Yep.
All right. And you've been listening to the first hour of Focus 580.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from Trophy Time in Champaign, with plaques and promotional products to recognize all occasions from athletic endeavors and musical moments to business achievements. Trophy Time, they're more than just trophies. Additional information available on the web at trophytime.com.
And I've been my pleasure to be with you this morning. And coming up next is Jay Pierce with the Market Reports. Jay?
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by AgriGold Hybrids, funding agricultural programming as an additional service to the many AgriGold customers in the AM 580 listening area. AgriGold, the corn after corn specialists. Information on the web at agrigold.com or by contacting Regional Sales Manager Scott Williamson at 217-778-6485 for representative nearest you.
Actually, it's Jeff Bonsert with a look at the markets at the... Kansas City July wheat at this time is at 603.5. That's up 5.5. September wheat at 595, up 4.25. Chicago Board of Trade July wheat at 595.5, up 7. September wheat at 605, up 5.5. December at 618.5, up 5.5. July corn at 338, up 5.5. September corn at 345.75, up 6.5. December corn at 357, up 6.75. July soybeans at 881, up 11. August soybeans at 885.5, up 10. July soybean meal at 240, up 310. July soybean oil at 37.58, up 26. August feeder cattle at 113.60, down 87.5. So August live cattle at 92.20, down 32.5. October live cattle at 96.60.